Hello and welcome to the podcast, What We Teach Our Children. I'm Kim Clyden. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent and empowered children? And they say it takes a village, or what we might call today a community. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded though by people who can support us, your family, friends and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Children are our future, and the very existence of the human race depends on what we teach them. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. This podcast is about everyone who plays a role in that story at every level of society. In this inaugural episode, we'll explore the early years of childhood through the experience of teacher, author and researcher Kari Sutton, who's worked with more than 25,000 parents, educators and others who care for children, helping them develop the skills and confidence to promote positive mental fitness in homes, schools and early childhood facilities. Thanks for joining me today, Kari. Why are you so passionate about helping people in this way?
The reason I do it is because if anybody has seen Dan Siegel's The Whole Brain Child, when we are little, so most probably even in utero, we pick up the energy that's around us. We pick up what's going on for our parents. And this is not about making parents feel any more guilt. I don't want parents to feel guilty. They're doing the best job they know how to with the tools they've got. What it's about is understanding that from conception all the way through to about five, that brain development that's happening then, they're sponges. Up until about 8 years of age, we don't have a filter. And what I mean by that is, one, what is really critical is they tell the truth and they'll call it how they see it because there is no filter. They don't understand that you don't say things to others just to please them, just to make them think that they like you. They will tell you the truth. But what they're doing is showing that that's what they're thinking. They don't understand that what we're saying to them may not be, and I don't want to say in their best interests, but to give you an example, don't cry. Big boys don't cry, or toughen up, princess. All those sorts of things. And when I work with adults, so where I've worked with a lot of teachers throughout my career. And when I talk about their own well-being, particularly their psychological well-being, what happens is I find out that they've got this itty-bitty shitty committee. Now, we all have this little voice and it sits on our shoulder. You're never going to be any good at this. You're not going to be able to do this. You're not going to be a successful teacher, whatever it is. And when we drill down back to where that originated, it will often be parents or teachers that have said things in offhand remarks, that possibly they've been tired or that it's just been frustrated and it's, oh, you're never going to get it, are you? Or you're not good at maths or those sorts of things that may have been throwaway comments for us when we're in those sorts of situations. That's where children actually go. It actually gets stored as a procedural memory. And what I mean by procedural memory is it's like riding a bike. It's like brushing our teeth. How we learn to parent is actually how we were parented. I'm sure you've experienced it. Sometimes I've opened my mouth and my mother's come out and you go, holy, I never wanted to be like that. And that's why I am so passionate about working with teachers, early childhood carers, early childhood educators, parents, grandparents, foster carers, whoever it is, because the foundations we lay in those 5 to 8 years, and if not before, so making sure that our pregnant mums aren't stressed or in those sorts of situations, if at all possible. But that is another thing. I haven't gotten that far yet, but where I go is saying, look, between 2 and 5, 2 and 8, we have to start being really aware. Now, I don't want people to beat themselves up. We all make mistakes. None of us are perfect. And it's not about being perfect. Our kids don't need us to be perfect. They need us to be present. They need us to be with them, to listen to them, to actually engage with them and know that Children crave connection. We all do. As humans, we crave connection. That's part of our psychological and emotional well-being, to have that connection with other people. And the longest study looking at emotional well-being, happiness, and psychological well-being that's gone on for over 70 years, it's out of Harvard. And admittedly, it was started with middle-class white men, but now they've added to the cohort over the 70 years. And it's actually been, I think, five or six generations of researchers that have been ongoing in this study. And what it looked at was, what are the underlying foundations? What has shown that you're going to have good psychological and emotional health and good physical health as well? And what it is, it's relationships and connection. Again, looking at with a child or with a young person, if you want them to develop as a resilient young person, the thing you need most of all, they need one high quality connection where that child knows that that person will be there for them no matter what. Come hell or high water, bad grades, wrong choices, all those sorts of things, that will help that child's social and emotional well-being as well as developing resilience in their life. What I'm seeing and what I've seen over my career is our mental health crisis is getting younger and younger. I've had young people as young as most probably 9 tell me that they don't want to live like this anymore. They would prefer to end their life. And that to me is heartbreaking. And it shows me that they have this thing as well, the itty bitty shitty committee. I don't call it an itty bitty shitty committee with them. I call it we might call it a negative Nelly, or we give it a name because it externalizes it for children. And, you know, negative Nancy or negative Neville, he always comes around. And do you think that's real? Like, do you think is that what you really can do? So we talk about how can they defeat the negative self-talk, because unless we challenge that, unless we help them get those skills and tools, we're not going to be able to address the mental health crisis.
It's not just mental health either. I mean, I agree with everything you've just said in relation to being a parent and a grandparent and watching children being exposed to so much more than we were ever exposed to in the 70s, and they thought television was bad. What role, from your perspective, does resilience and emotional well-being play in a human being's development into adulthood?
If our kids aren't resilient, and resilience is bounced around a lot, like it's a buzzword at the moment, but what it is actually looking and saying, I know that life is not going to be a straight road, that it's not going to be all unicorns and roses. It's actually going to be some potholes. Resilience is actually having the tools and the skills and the ability to get themselves out of the potholes that they experience. I've talked to many people and families around how do we teach our children positive body image, because what they're seeing in the media and what they're exposed to from a really young age is, oh, girls look like this, or and this is what is pretty, this is what is respected. And again, social media, and I'm not demonizing social media. Social media has a place, or the internet and being online has a place for our young people's mental health and well-being. It's just what they're seeing and the dominant culture that's around that can be very detrimental to their psychological and emotional well-being. So young people with high resilience, they're willing to try more often. They're willing to fail. I believe that there's lessons that everybody needs to learn. And at first it will be a pebble that will hit you. Then it might be a bigger stone. Then it might be a brick. You do not want to get hit by a boulder in life. Children or young people who learn that if I have a pebble that's a consequence, and that I'm supported in this network of support and care in my family, with my grandparents or with teachers, that's the most supported they're ever going to be in their life. When they go out to work, they're not going to have that support network. And research done at Stanford and Yale in the States about 5 years ago. It was before COVID. They went and asked freshmen. So these are kids who have just shown up at uni, and they went in after 6 months and they said, look, your parents prepared you well. Like, you're here at one of the most prestigious schools. What do you wish your parents would have taught you before you came? These were the things that came out: not getting their own way, dealing with loneliness, not having friends. And also one of the big kickers was not being able to deal with failure. If that's what's happening in college, we have to backward chain and say, how do we teach our kids this? What's worrying me at the moment is the rise of the appeal of Andrew Tate online. And this is, I'm seeing this in grades 5 and 6, definitely in the last 2 years of primary school and into high school at the moment. We need to start teaching our children respect of all persons and the worth of all persons. Because unless we start doing this early, those people and those attitudes are going to be appealing. If children have a firm foundation of, I respect my mum, my aunt, my female teacher, or things like that, they will be less likely to take in those ideas and those conversations.
I'm wondering if that runs both ways in relation to respect. Traditionally, we talk about children being seen and not heard. We instruct them to hug people. Where does social norms set us up for failure?
You touched on it right there. Often we're asking our children to go sit or be cuddled by something that is uncomfortable for them. And I know I was guilty of it. When Mitchell was growing up, it was, oh, we're going to have a photo with Santa. I don't want to have a photo with Santa. Santa's scary. Santa's big, red, has a beard, can have a gruff voice. And if I had my time again, I may have a photo with Santa with me and my child on my lap, not on Santa's lap. It's around saying and giving our children permission to actually say, no, I don't want to do it. You want the children to respect you, you have to respect them. I will always say, please, thank you. It's great to see you. It's about the unconditional positive regard. I may not like your behavior, but I will always care about you. They love grandma and grandpa, but they may not like the whiskery kisses they get. And therefore, if they don't like the whiskery kisses, we need to be standing up with them, because think about a small child, and a small child's ability to say no to somebody is really hard. They want to please us. If you, again, going back to being a race that wants connection, that's how we actually survive. If you think about the human race, if you are ostracized and you sit outside the herd, you are most probably going to die. And when we're fearful of not fitting in, of not being accepted, of not being liked, that's going to make you ostracized. And that's unsafe. And that's what it feels for a child. And that's concerning because, and I'm not sure if you know, I worked with abused children in my early part of my career. And that's how predators, unfortunately, prey on children. They get that it's a secret. Don't tell anybody. And children don't want to do things that are going to get their parents in trouble, that are going to get them in trouble, or anybody else they care about. And so these are the sorts of things we actually need to teach our children. It's okay to say no. It's okay if you don't want somebody touching you, and if you don't want to do something, it's okay. And as the significant adult in their lives, we need to stand behind them, because adults often don't listen to children. And I'm not saying that in a patronizing or condescending way, and that, oh, we have to listen to children and do exactly what they say. No, what we do need to do is listen to children when they say no, because behavior is a form of communication. If a child is behaving in a certain way, that's the tip of the iceberg. What you need to look at is what's underneath the iceberg and say, we need to discuss that. And we also need to give them power, because when they say no and we're backing them, we lend them our power.
If we don't start teaching children consent at that age, and we're betraying their consent through controlling what they do with their bodies, what message are we sending?
Exactly. I'm not trying to make parents feel guilty. This isn't about looking at that. I don't know if you've heard of Pareto Principle, 80-20. Honestly, if 80% of the time we're listening, we're attending, that 20% where we go, would you just be quiet? I've got to do this, or just stay out. That won't matter, because it's what we do the majority of the time.
But you have to have boundaries, don't you? I mean, there has to be rules, laws, regulations. That's how the world works.
And that is critically important, because a lot of people, and what I'm seeing often these days as a teacher and deputy and guidance officer, is parents are scared to put boundaries in place. Children need boundaries. Children will push. They will keep pushing until they find where that firm line is. Because ultimately what they want is to feel that they're in a safe pair of hands. I've got you. I am the adult. That's my job. Might not like it. And I'm not here to be your friend. I'm here to help you and to keep you safe and to love you unconditionally.
Given that many people only experience parenting through modeling, how do you think we should approach that educationally speaking?
again, you look at driving a car and we're given a manual, but raising kids, we just assume that, oh, everything will be fine because they know how to do it. And that's often what I see with young parents particularly. Mums these days are so incredibly anxious. They don't know how to do it. They don't want to pass their anxiety onto their children. A highly anxious mum will have a highly anxious child because that's what that child is experiencing. And again, emotions are contagious. As I say to teachers, you are the barometer for the room. The attitudes, the emotions, that's contagious. Children will catch that and they will rise to meet that emotion and energy. And it could be a bang because they'll feel it and they won't understand it. About parenting, we don't have a village anymore. Because so many people are socially isolated, they don't have that to draw on. So where do we go and how can we help people? It's about an education piece and it's looking and saying, what can we do? That's why I love the books you've written, because books for children are things parents can sit and read with them. They can spend that time and that's quality time. And it's when they think back, even if you close your eyes now as an adult listening to this pod, what you will remember if you've got positive childhood memories is often sitting on a parent's lap reading. You'll remember those stories. And so how we can help parents is say, not be down on them, not be judgmental. I often say to people, when you see a young mum at a playground with her child swinging or playing and she's on her phone, please don't judge. Because you don't know what she's been through. That may be her only lifeline. She may be a single mum who hasn't got any other time, who comes to the playground because she knows that her child can get out in the fresh air, that this is her time. We are way more judgmental these days when we look at how parents are parenting their kids. But if you see somebody who's really struggling in the supermarket, say, hey, can I give a hand? They may not want it, but they may also go, oh, yeah, I'm having a really hard time. Extending grace. Extending kindness and compassion, being less judgmental, but also being role models.
The old saying, it takes a village, it resonates even today with community.
Yes, it really does. It's actually saying teachers, healthcare workers, after school hour care workers, early childhood educators, all of those people wrap around our kids and our families, because ultimately what we need them to know is their support, they're not alone, and that they're doing an okay job. You're doing the best you can with the knowledge you've got. When you get more knowledge, when you get more support, when you get more input, then you'll do better. Don't beat yourself up for what's happened now. Just understand that when I have more knowledge, exactly as I explained with Santa and Mitchell, I most probably wouldn't have said, because I know I'll put my hand up and say, I used to say, oh, you need to say thank you. And again, that's a societal expectation. All of these societal expectations that we place on our kids. We want to be seen as good parents, or we want the children to be seen as good children who have manners, is teaching them that they actually have to bend over backwards to please people. We're training kids to be people pleasers. And I'm a recovering people pleaser. I know I am that. And I know I've had to work hard at being, because I didn't have good boundaries and I would get walked over. I would always say yes and take way too much on. These are the sorts of things that we unconsciously pass on to our children when we say, oh, you have to do this or you've got to eat that. So it's not about pandering to children, because often when people say, oh, you're just giving in to children. No. What I'm doing is giving children a voice and allowing them to have their say and being interested in what they're saying, because research has shown even children as young as 2, 3, and 4 can tell you what they like and don't like, how things work or how they perceive things work. And children know what goes on at home, and they'll tell you things like, oh, daddy's had an operation and he has to sit on a ring pillow. He's got a donut for a cushion. And you know exactly what the operation was, but nobody's telling you a thing. And so when you see dad hobbling in, you go, I know what that's from. So Children know. Young children know what's going on. They know, but they often can't express it. So what we really like is to give our kids the tools and skills to thrive as adults. And that's where understanding resilience and how you can develop it, developing emotional intelligence and well-being, developing mental fitness so they take care of their mental health. Just like we teach kids to slip, slop, slap and put on sunscreen, we can teach them how to take care of their brains. We can teach them how to take care of their emotional health and well-being. And I've got to admit, Gen Z now is much more aware of their mental health and is willing to put boundaries in place around that. However, to a certain degree, it might have gone a pendulum swung in a hugely different direction. Oh, I've got to take a mental health day because somebody gave me negative feedback. Guess what? Negative feedback is a part of life. Negative feedback is something you need to learn how to deal with because it's going to happen. People are going to say bad things to you. It's like teaching children how to deal with bullies. I would love to wave a magic wand and make bullying go away. It's not going to go away. You can see bullying in a variety of different spheres. It doesn't just happen at school.
So, Kari, just to summarise, I want to ask you one question that I probably won't be able to ask anybody else. As an educator, do you think it would be helpful in schools to have an introduction to things like self-care, parenting, those types of skills to better prepare our children to be greater leaders in the future?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without a shadow of a doubt, I would say 100%. I know when young women have to look after a baby, not a human baby, but a doll, it wakes up in the middle of the night, all of those sorts of things. It makes them think. It teaches them about responsibility. Mm. That's why I often say to parents, look, get your children dogs. Get them something that they have to look after and that it's their job to look after. Because again, we need to teach our kids these things in schools. We need to teach them about the responsibility, about relationships, what it looks like. There's no such thing as perfect parenting, but what we do is say, you know what? There isn't a manual, but what we can do, and that's why I wrote Raising a Mentally Fit Generation, because I wanted to say, you don't have to be perfect, but understand that these are the sorts of things that you can teach. You can teach your kids to be more optimistic, to be kind, empathic, compassionate people. You can teach them about their brains. You can teach them how to be a good friend, because we need to teach our kids that some friends aren't good friends. Not everybody is a good friend. And unless they realize that, they will be taken advantage of.
There's only what you can do with the tools you have. And I think if one thing we can take away from you is that we can learn these skills, we can reach out, we can ask for help. Kari Sutton, you've been an amazing guest. And I really can't wait to have you back on my show again soon.
Thank you so much.
Educator, author and researcher Kari Sutton providing an insight on her tools and strategies to build resilience and well-being in our children. You can find more practical advice in Kari's book, Raising a Mentally Fit Generation. In our next episode, social scientist Andrea Canaris speaks with me about her social impact research, the neuroscience behind hugging, and the ongoing impact of COVID lockdown on our mental health. Don't miss the tools she recommends to cope with loneliness and isolation.